Hello, and welcome to the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative to record America's family history in sound. Oral histories are one of the most personal and rewarding ways to preserve family stories. The Tell Me a Story sessions are 45-minute interviews between two people with the assistance of a trained facilitator. Participants will receive a compact disc with the full interview. A copy will be archived at the Midwest Genealogy Center and, with permission, later made available to the public. And now, another story.
Hello. My name is Nancy Melton, Hillel, and I am in Independence, Missouri today, May 1st, 2016. I'm with my mother, Jean Edith Bender Melton, and we are going to do a little interview and discussion about my maternal grandmother. My maternal grandmother was Edith Caroline Schneider Bender. She was born December 18, 1887, and she died in July of 1974 in Monticello, Iowa. Edith was the child of a Swiss immigrant, Isaac Schneider. He had been born in Aargau, Switzerland back in 1853. He died in 1932 in Monticello, Iowa. Isaac immigrated to the United States with his brother Jacob. When they arrived, it was about 1871 or 72, and they landed in New York. Supposedly, they took a train west and went just as far as the train would go. Then, the family legend at least says, they took an ox cart and kept going west looking for good land. Their brothers settled in the small town of Cascade, Iowa, but later moved to Monticello, Iowa, which is a town with a lot of Swiss and German residents and immigrants. My mother always said that when she grew up in Monticello, Iowa, almost everyone in town was related to her in some way. My grandmother's mother was Louisa Heisler, who was born in 1863 to German immigrants who were living in Poughkeepsie, New York. She and her family moved to Monticello about 1871, and she stayed there until she died in 1928. Isaac and Louisa married in Monticello in December of 89, that is 1879, and they had seven children. When they were raising their children, the parents spoke German, but the children had to answer a different way. Mom, can you tell us how the children had to answer their parents?
Well, the children had to learn to speak English, and so that was the requirement. The parents would speak in their native tongue, German, and then the children would respond in English. That, of course, helped them learn the English language so they could go to school, but I think it must have helped the parents learn the English language just as well.
Well, did they ever get confused by having the parents speaking German and the kids responding in English?
It was kind of confusing when Grandpa, Red Ike, would told Edith to go on over there and get me a cup of coffee off of that pot of coffee that's on the stove. And be sure and shake it. Well, Edith did exactly what she was told. She went to the stove and got the pot of coffee, shook it good, and poured a cup of coffee that was full of nice grounds. Grandpa didn't exactly appreciate that, but that's what he said. That's what he told her to do.
So she could not detect in his German the sarcasm or the joke that he was trying to make?
Nope. That's what he said. So she had to do it. She was taught to obey.
Well, Edith attended school in Monticello, I think, for all of her education up through high school. Tell me about how she went through high school.
Edith was very intelligent, and she even skipped grades because they didn't think she needed to cover that material again. And then she graduated a little earlier than most children did. And I know exactly the year that she graduated, and I've never forgotten, because my mother Edith taught me the school yell that they had for their class. Goodness gracious sakes alive, we're the class of 1905.
And I can tell you, once you hear that, you never forget it. When she was in high school, did Edith get to select what kind of classes she would take, or how did they handle that?
Our town of Monticello was just really kind of progressive. We had, as we went to high school, we had a choice of what we were allowed to take. And if you wanted to go into business after high school, which most people went right to work, then you would take typing and you'd take bookkeeping and anything that would be along the business line. Now, if you wanted to be a teacher, they had a course called normal training, I think, and you would take the courses that led up to that. And then you were qualified to teach in the local country school as soon as you graduated from high school.
So when Edith graduated as a teenager in 1905, did she start teaching right away?
Right out of high school, she taught in the country school.
And was that, did she still live in Monticello and have to travel to the country school every day?
Yes, and you know how they traveled. They didn't have a car. So Edith had to ride her horse out into the country.
Well, wait a minute. This is back in the day when women would wear dresses down to the ground and button-top shoes. How did she get on a horse in that kind of outfit?
That's a mystery to me. I wasn't there. And I thought maybe she could step on a, you know, had a stepladder and get in, get on there. And I'm sure it must have been a side saddle or something. And go out there. But what did she do after she got out in the country? How did she get back on the horse?
I don't know.
I don't either.
Well, let's skip that one since we don't know. What happened when she got out to the school? It was a country school. And how many teachers were there?
One teacher.
Was there a janitor?
It was one room. Oh. It was one room. She taught everything. She had to get it all ready for the day. First thing she probably did was to build the fire. There was a potbelly stove in the middle of the room, and that heated up the whole room. So she had to get that going. And then she had to sweep out the floor, and she had to get the books ready and raise the flag and have everything ready for when the children got there at school.
And so how many grades would she teach at the same time?
She taught all 8 grades.
And so the 8th graders in the country school would go to high school in town, is that right?
If they graduated. And that was the one burden of the teacher. She had to be sure that when she was teaching those children, that by the time they graduated from 8th grade in country school, they would be able to pass the tests to be able to go into town to finish their high school.
What happened if they didn't pass the test?
Then they had to find a job. Either in, if they were farmers, and that was a country school, so maybe they just went back home and stayed at home to help, or went someplace else and tried to get a job. But they didn't get to go to school anymore if they didn't pass that test.
Wow. Well, did Edith keep teaching in the country school, or did she decide to make a change?
I think she enjoyed it, because she certainly enjoyed teaching us at home and everything that we had to do. But she always wanted to go to business school. I think you have to, if somebody else can go beyond high school and you haven't gone, I think you have that desire to continue your education. And so she went to Cedar Rapids to business school.
How far from Monticello, Iowa, is Cedar Rapids?
Cedar Rapids is 30 miles.
30 miles. So when she went to business school there, did she go and live in Cedar Rapids, or did she stay in Monticello?
Nobody had cars, hardly anybody. And you either went by train or horse or however you could get there. And she went to Cedar Rapids, and she lived in a boarding house.
While she was in Cedar Rapids and she went to business school, did she also work, or how did she support herself?
When she got through with business school, then she got a job in what they call a Chautauqua office.
Is that the Chautauqua program that back in the days that she was doing this would provide programs of entertainment or education to the different towns that go around and take programs to various towns?
Yes. And so she was in charge of getting all the business part of getting those, these charts?
Posters?
Posters ready.
Flyers,
and getting those all ready to go, and so that the person that went out to sell and promote these things would be ready for them.
And who was the person who was going out to sell and promote the Chautauqua programs?
Well, isn't that strange that you would ask?
Yes.
James C. Bender, James Calvin Bender. He was one of the best, I'm sure. And he got on the train, and he would go out, and he would sell these programs, and then he would come back and report. And I'm sure he hung around the office quite a while.
Because, as it turns out, James C. Bender and Edith married January 10th, 1910, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That was after they met in the Chautauqua office, right?
I'm sure that didn't hurt at all.
You know, it's interesting to me that they married in Minneapolis. That was far away from family and friends, and it looks like they eloped. Did they ever talk to you about that?
Never said a word.
Interesting. So early in their marriage, J.C. and Edith lived in South Dakota. What was your dad doing for a living
what
at that time?
What was the name of that town in South Dakota?
I don't know.
I did know. But anyway, he worked for the Sunshine Biscuit Company when he was there.
And I think that your first two siblings, James and Mary, were both born in South Dakota.
They were cute little kids.
I bet. After they lived in South Dakota with J.C., who is what your dad was called, was selling biscuits, then they moved to Oklahoma to farm. Why did they go there?
My dad, J.C. Bender's uncle, who was a twin to his mother, my grandmother, Mary Bender. And he had a farm in Oklahoma, and whether they went down to farm his land or whether they had another farm, anyway, he was persuasive in getting them to come to Oklahoma and farm. He figured it's probably better than working for the Sunshine Biscuit Company.
Well, when J.C. and Edith went to Oklahoma, she had three children. The first one was your sister Ruth, and then who was born?
The Esther and Fern. Esther and Fern are identical twins. And for identical twins to live in that time and age, especially in Oklahoma and that area, it was such an oddity that people from all around would come and they'd want to see those twins, the identical twins that had managed to live and be healthy.
Kind of funny to have your babies be sightseeing objects, I guess.
Maybe you enjoyed that because they were twins. identical.
Well, yes. And after they lived in Oklahoma for a few years and the twins were born, then J.C. and Edith moved back to do some farming in Iowa. But they had a problem, I think. What was that?
Well, when you farm in Iowa, your crops are going to grow. It's just a wonderful place to farm. And they did. The crops just flourished there. But the only trouble with farming in that place was that a steam engine train would go through that property, and it would spew sparks all over. And in the fall, when things were ready to be harvested, and these ripe crops, and the sparks from the steam engine would set a fire to the crops and burn a good share of them.
And so they probably didn't have insurance or anything, so that was a problem to have your crops burn up every year.
Yeah, when you can't sell anything, it's going to cut into your income
I guess.
Pretty much.
So by about 1919, I think that J.C. and Edith moved back to Edith's hometown, which was Monticello, Iowa, and they lived there the rest of their lives. Edith then had five more children, and they were born all at home. And they were Charles, Paul, Ralph, yourself, Mom Jean, and Catherine. So in total, your mother raised 10 children, all of them to adulthood. That's pretty amazing back in those days.
Yeah, it was fun, though. Listen, you just gave birth at home. You just called up Dr. Frazier, and he'd come running right down to help, and you had your birth at home, and all the other children would come in as soon as it was cleaned up and ready and examine the children.
Pass along the measles. So anyway, while they were in Monticello, J.C. found a job working for Sinclair Refinery. What did he have to do for Sinclair?
He had a big tank truck, and on the side of it was a place where you put big 10-gallon drums of soap that they used in the service stations. And there was big enough place there. Sometimes we'd get on there, Kay and I would at least get in there, and Dad would give us a ride downtown, which was a block away. And then he would have to carry gasoline from his tank truck to the gas stations or out in the country. And then he'd have to come back and refill that tank truck so he'd be ready for the next day.
So he would pick up the gasoline from a facility in the town of Monticello and go out to the farmers in the neighboring areas, right?
Yes, and also the gas stations.
And the gas stations,
too. He'd fill those up. Yeah. When he'd go to the countryside, he'd have to fill up a 5-gallon can of gas, and he'd have to carry that over to there, wherever they wanted it stored. And in the gas station, where it took many, many more gallons, and he just had a big hose that he put in for their tank.
So out with the farmers, he had to carry the gas, but
yes,
in town he could put a hose for the gas stations.
He had to be pretty strong to carry that heavy can of gasoline.
And so did your mom, Edith, participate in any way in J.C.'s business for Sinclair?
When he got the job as an agent for the Sinclair Refining Company, my mother got the job as bookkeeper for the company. J.C. didn't keep the books. It was my mother now had a home business that she added on to taking care of all the family.
And what did she do anything as far as answering his phone? Was she his receptionist? What else did she do besides the books?
He had to be home all the time to answer the phones because we didn't have a secretary. Mother was the secretary and the bookkeeper, and she had to be sure that the phone orders were taken, because if you didn't answer the phone, nobody's going to call back again to get you to come out and get somebody else.
So did that impact your ability to use the phone as a kid?
We didn't know there was a phone. It was a business phone, and its phone number was 200.
That's the whole number?
That's the number, 200. Well, I think if I remember, the hospital was 117. A lot of numbers in Monticello.
Yeah, maybe 300. So, in any event, when Edith was, even though she's handling the business of the Sinclair gasoline distribution, she also is having to feed your entire family. I know you've told me that she and J.C. had a garden. Tell me what they grew and what things that they raised in the garden.
Well, J.C. would go out in the early spring and dig up the garden, the whole space. And we had one whole section that we could put in tomatoes, because they take up a lot of space. And also, we love tomatoes. And we also ate them, used them in soup, and Mother canned them for the next winter. And we'd have beets and anything that didn't take up too much space. Radishes and lettuce and pole beans that we climb up on a pole, and just every vegetable that we could do. And they were always in straight lines.
She also raised radishes, didn't she?
Oh, yes. They were good to pull out and just eat right out of that.
Oh, disgusting. But anyway, I know you used to eat radish sandwiches, which just shocks me. While she was raising this garden, were your brothers or was she raising any animals in the backyard, too?
Oh, we did have. We had a chicken coop, and it wasn't a big one, and we didn't have too many. But we had enough to enjoy the eggs that they produced. And then at the end of the season, when they got pretty big, why, we'd kill a chicken for chicken soup, or usually by the time they got old, they were pretty tough. So they usually made chicken soup.
And did one of your brothers raise anything else?
Oh, yes. Chuck loved rabbits. And I'm not sure he raised them for food. I think more for pets. But he had rabbits that he took care of.
But the family did eat some of them, right?
Oh, yes. We ate everything.
Poor Chuck.
Raised everything.
And did your brothers ever go hunting or find wild game for the family?
They thought they were pretty good hunters, and every once in a while they'd go out and they'd be hunting for rabbits or squirrels. And I think that's about all that they were able to bring back as with their guns.
But one time they brought back something unusual.
Yes. They came in, and all the girls, of course, screamed, "Ah!" And it was a huge turtle. And Mother was pleased. She saw this big turtle, and she saw food on the table. And she was glad to have it, and we had turtle soup, and it was good.
So with all these vegetables and other things that are growing in the backyard, how did you preserve it for the winter?
We can most things. We didn't have a freezer. We didn't even have an electric refrigerator to keep things cold. So we would have to learn how to can them. We canned all the vegetables that we could grow, and we can peaches and from Georgia peaches and some pears from someplace else. And somebody would give us apples, and they'd make applesauce. And everything was put in jars for the next winter.
I think I've heard you say that there were hundreds, literally hundreds, of jars of canned food at the beginning of the winter. Is that right?
Oh, yes. We had a large family, and we had to feed them through the winter.
Now, what about things like pickles or sauerkraut? Did your mom make those, too?
That was fun to watch. We had two big crocks that would be in the basement, and Mother would put the pickling cucumbers, they were a little smaller than the large ones, and put those in the crocks, and then put water in there and enough salt that to cover them, the water to cover them, that's the salt to float an egg. And if it had that, it was ready to be preserved. And then they put a lid on and weighed it down with a brick on top.
And so what you do, just leave the cucumbers in the salty mixture for a while? Or
yeah, they would have to be cured and put back into a jar and canned. And if you wanted sour pickles or dill pickles, you'd go out and get the dried dill and from the garden and put the dill in each jar, some dill in each jar. And that would be for the dill pickles. And if you wanted to have sweet pickles, then she'd have to put the smaller pickles in there and put vinegar and sugar kind of combination, I think.
So then those were canned after you put those seasonings in with them. And then the sauerkraut, how did she make sauerkraut?
I remember them going in this great huge crock that's in the basement. We had to take the cabbage and shred it all until that big crock was full, cover it with water and salt to float an egg, and put a weight on top of it to keep the sauerkraut down and let it ferment. Now, I don't remember what we did after it got ready. We must have canned it some way because you couldn't eat it out of that big crock forever. So it must have been put in jars too and canned.
Otherwise, it would turn into sauerkraut wine or something. I don't know.
There's no freezer, so we couldn't put it in the freezer.
So when your mom is trying to feed 10 kids and she's doing all this canning, does she have like a technique to make sure that there's going to be enough food for everybody at all the meals?
Everything was counted. Everything was divided before it was put on the table. If we had steak, and we did have round steak once in a while, we'd go over to 50 Cents, go to Uncle Ike's butcher shop, and get it and bring it home, this round steak, cut it up into the number of pieces that we had for the people that were going to eat the meal that day. And so when it passed, you took one piece, and it went on to the next person, and everybody got their share. And other things were cut into the same size. The peaches and the pears were counted as they went into the jars for canning. So everybody knew what was their share.
So she made sure that she'd only have to open one jar, for example, of peaches for one meal because it would be the right number of peaches for
That's
the
right.
people that would be eating.
And if it wasn't quite enough, Mom was the one that went without.
Or it's not fair.
Sometimes maybe she'd divide up a piece for the kids, the smallest ones.
Well, aside from doing all this gardening and cooking and canning, your mom had a lot of other chores to do, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about her today. How did she divide up or organize all these things she had to do?
Well, the work week was usually divided into what you'd considered this is the chore that you were going to do for that day. And then that's the way we did it.
So what did she do on Mondays?
On Monday was usually, we were in charge of laundry.
And that's a laundry for a family of 12 people, right?
Right.
So how did she begin that?
Well, it was wash day, so you got up really early. You had to fill this big copper tub of full water and put it on the stove, which you had to start with. It was a wood-burning stove, and that had to be going. And we had to wait until that big tub of water was boiling hot.
So the stove, the only stove that your mom was using for heating this water or for all the cooking that she did, was wood-fired?
Yes, and it had 6 burners, so it was a big stove.
So once she gets this tub back to the laundry then, she gets this big copper tub, it's full of water, it's hot, now what does she do?
She called J.C.
And what did he
JC?
Have to do?
J.C.!
I remember calling him like that.
and he'd come running because he knew what his job was to do. He had to carry that heavy, big...
Copper tub.
All the way down into the basement where we did our laundry.
And I remember that house. He would have had to take that tub full of water, which had to be incredibly heavy, from the stove... out the back door, down the back steps, around the side yard, down into the basement from an outside entrance, and they were stone, rickety steps down into the basement of the house.
Yes.
How in the heck did he do that?
I don't know.
I don't either. So what did he do with the water once it was down there?
That went into the Maytag washer, and I think for us it must have been a fairly new one within the last 10 years because it was one of the new square tub Maytags.
When you're talking about in the last 10 years, you're saying that in the 1930s and 1940s, that's when you had this Maytag, right? That's when you were growing
yes.
up. And so was it like the machines we have today? You put the clothes in, you close the lid, and you come back an hour later and they're ready?
That'd be strange.
No,
we had to pour that heavy hot water into the tub. Then we had to be sure that it had good soap, probably shaved Fell's naphtha soap, and that had to be swishing around, and so we had a good suds. And then you could start your laundry. The white clothes first, and then the lighter clothes as they went out. And we would wash them there, and then they had to go through the wringer into the rinse water, and then they had to be rinsed up and down, till all the clothes had no more soap, and then they would go through the wringer again to a second tub of water, and sometimes you'd even put a drop or two of bluing, and that was supposed to make the clothes whiter. And then you'd go up and down, raise and lower the clothes to get the soap out so that it was surely gone, and through the wringer again, and into the basket that go up those stairs and out to hang in the yard.
So I just want to clarify. So the clothes, all the clothes for the entire family were washed in the same water that was heated on the stove that JC brought down and poured into the machine.
Yes.
Every single thing.
But it started with the light clothes first.
Right.
So they were bright and clean.
And then you had to take each item and get it out of the Maytag agitator, put it into rinse water, run it through a wringer, put it into more rinse water, run it through a wringer, and then hang it up.
That's right.
Okay, so the only thing the machine did was agitate the soap and water. Everything else was pretty much done by hand.
Well, and the wringer, you didn't have to push the wringer. It did it for you.
It was moved by a machine.
Yes.
Okay, so when you go to hang the clothes up outside, how did you do that, or how did your mother do that?
Well, the outside clothesline was long, and it was the whole length of our backyard. And sometimes the clotheslines would sink when they got extra clothes. So they took an extra 1x2 pole and put two nails in the end of it and put the rope between that, and to raise the clothes after we had them all hung up, and so that they would get dry.
I remember seeing that pole. It was just an ancient piece of wood, a tall stick with two nails, so that the clothesline could go between the two nails, and then they'd prop the bottom in the dirt, and it mm-hmm. would be like, I don't know, something on a bridge holding it up so that sheets wouldn't hit the ground. So after you put the pole up and you put the sheets up, what did you do next to dry clothes?
The sheets were strung up next to the neighbors. That way the neighbors couldn't tell all the things that we had hanging on our clothes. And of course the underwear was closer to the house, because we didn't want to have anyone see that.
So your underwear was hidden.
Oh yes.
What did you do, though, if it was winter and you had to dry clothes?
We still had to hang them up out in the yard. Some of the smaller things I don't think ever got to be on them. They would put those things on the radiators. We had radiators all through the house, and we would put those on. But the sheets and big things were hung outside until they were stiff. And then they were brought in later on in the day, and we hung them back up inside with clotheslines that we hung into the dining room. But they were almost freeze-dried.
So even though they were frozen, they still came back in more dry than they went out.
Yes.
And then you hung them in the dining room to finish the drying.
And when you came in on March day, it was so moist and nice and smelled so good from clean clothes.
I bet you didn't let any neighbors in, because there might be underwear on the radiator, too. What did your mother do on Tuesdays?
Tuesday was ironing day, and you'd have to sprinkle the dry clothes and get them ready. And we had an iron that was, you'd put the iron on the stove to get it hot, and then you had a handle, it was a wooden handle that clamped onto that iron that was on the stove. And we had a some newspaper on the end of the ironing board that we'd test the iron to see if it was wasn't too hot. Because if it scorched the paper, you certainly didn't want to use it yet. So you'd have to wait till it cooled down a little, because you cannot ruin some clothes with a big scorch on it.
So if it didn't scorch the newspaper, it was safe to put on the clothing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So after doing the ironing on Tuesday, what did Edith do on Wednesdays?
Wednesday was the day that you didn't say anything and you were quiet in the house when you came in, because that was the day that my mother had to get the books ready to be sent out for that day and to go to the bank to enter the money into the credit of the bank.
Are you talking about the books for the Sinclair refining business that your dad ran?
Oh, yeah. This was the day she had to get these huge ledgers the size of a newspaper, and she had to add up all the the credits and the debits, and she had only a pencil and paper to use it, no adding machines or anything to help her. She had to use her brain, and boy, could she do it.
So then she has to do all the bookkeeping on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And then you said something about taking something to the bank. What did she do?
Well, before she went to the bank, she had to go upstairs and get on her Sunday clothes. Because you don't go to the bank dressed in house clothes.
But the bank's only two blocks away from your house.
But it's a bank. And this is a business trip. So she had to look her part. And she changed into a Sunday dress and put on her Sunday shoes, and her silk stockings that didn't have a run in them.
To go two blocks.
Yes.
Okay.
But it was the bank.
I understand. So on Thursdays, I understand that she didn't really have a particular thing assigned, but she did a lot of making clothes and things on Thursdays. Is that right?
That was a day when she could kind of do other things around the house that needed to be done. She'd make clothes, and she even made quilts, and she would make new clothes and remake clothes and remake patterns and do rugs and everything else.
Well, Ma, you've told me that she even made the girls dresses out of flour sacks.
Especially during the wartime, I remember that the flour came in really pretty material. And that was something that our family wasn't the only one that had dresses made out of these flour sacks. They were pretty flowered flour sacks. And so we were glad to get those. But I don't know how you make it. Maybe she had to have two the same color. But these were big flour sacks, 50 pounds, I think, maybe.
And did she also even make coats?
Out of other people's coats.
What do you mean?
She didn't go over to the store and buy the material and make the coats. So she would go to maybe a rummage sale, or maybe Aunt Louise would have a coat that she didn't want anymore, or somebody else in the neighborhood or the family didn't want their old coats. And so they'd give them to her, and she would make a pattern and cut them down to size. And I remember the first picture I think I ever had taken of me was outside with that coat on. And I said I knew she made it from an old coat because it had a fur collar.
So you figure it was some adult's coat that she cut down for you?
Oh, yeah, no doubt was.
All right. And I, even more embarrassing, I understand she made your underwear.
Yes, out of cotton. White, and it had elastic at the top and elastic legs, and both legs were made out of plastic, and they're kind of bloomers, they called them, and puffy, and you push up and pull up those legs, and you looked really cute, we thought. Until
hopefully no one would see them.
Oh, but they did. I have a picture of my first grade class, and here I am in the front row, as always, because I'm the shortest one forever. And if you look carefully, my bloomer is on one leg, is below my dress.
Oh, my.
Yes, embarrassing.
Well, besides sewing underwear, Edith would also be able to knit and crochet. What did she knit and crochet for you guys?
Well, she knit all of our mittens, all mittens and our hats and scarves, and I don't think she knit socks, but she'd knit things to wear around the house.
Slippers?
Slippers of some kind, yeah. And they were really, really nice. And she'd crochet the finer things, like on a pillowcase she'd crochet. Sometimes she'd crochet a little baby booties or something like that. Mostly she knit, but she could make mittens and hats and booties and sweaters and
You told me she even crocheted doilies.
Oh, yes. Oh, your tables and things, your stands would have to have something on them to pretty. And like that chair you're sitting in, it has a doily in the back. She would crochet those kind of things.
One of the stories that always amazed me the most was that she actually made rugs. How did she make rugs?
Out of old clothing. You see, nothing went to waste. And people's clothes tore. And so she'd tear them into strips of about 1.5 inches wide, sew them the strips together until she had enough, and then she would crochet with a big crochet, wooden crochet needle, and it would crochet those rugs together.
And then she made braided rugs too, didn't she?
The braided rugs were harder, and it took heavier materials, so she would have to make those out of old coats or old suits or whatever.
And you told me that she used her brother Albert's World War I Navy uniform to make a braided rug.
Yes.
That's just amazing to me. How did she do that?
Well, you had to make them in the strips, just like you did the other one, and then you'd have to have three big balls so that you could braid that material, the heavy material, together. And when you had enough strips or enough length, then you would sew those together until you either made it into an oblong shape or you made it into a round shape. And then it took a lot of work and a long time to get a rug big enough for a room.
So she made a braided rug as big as a full room rug.
Yes.
Wow. Well, what'd she do on Fridays after all this work?
She must have been exhausted.
Yes.
By then, it was time to clean the house. So you had to scrub the floors. You had to, sometimes on her hands and knees, you'd have to hang those rugs that gotten dirty, if they were those kind of rugs, and put them on the clothesline, and they had an instrument that looked like a tennis racket, and you'd beat the rugs, and that would get the dirt out of them. We didn't have a vacuum sweeper. We had a carpet sweeper that could take the dirt off the top of the rug, but we couldn't get the dirt out of the rug, so you had to beat them out.
You told me that you guys all liked that.
Oh, it was fun. Oh, that was fun. Everybody took their turn. Everybody wanted to help on that.
Beat the rugs.
Outside and beat the rug. See if you could. Sometimes it didn't go very far, you know, and the bigger kids could make the rug swing on the line, but I was glad if I even got it anywhere.
So the house was heated with coal. Did that cause any special need for cleaning?
The folks always did all their painting around the house and all their wallpapering. And then when you had the coal furnace, it got dirty. And so that caused for another job. And you had to take this wallpaper cleaner. It was a gummy kind of stuff. And you'd mold it into your hand and work it for a while. And then you'd very carefully rub the wallpaper from left to right until you got that clean, and then pretty soon if that got a little bit dirty, you'd fold that back in until the piece of wallpaper got pretty dark and dirty. And then
you mean
that
piece of cleaning stuff got dark?
Yes, okay. That's what I meant to say.
I knew you did. It really sounds like silly putty.
It's very similar.
And just sticking it on the wall and pulling off the dirt.
Yeah, you didn't stick it. You just kind of moved it across gently.
Well, what about Saturday?
Saturday usually was baking day. We had to get ready for Sunday and see that everything was ready because the stores were closed on Sunday. And Sunday was church day. So most things had to be done on Saturday to get ready. And it was baking day very often. And we made Parker House rolls. Those were three little rolls put together into a
muffin tin.
And then she made other rolls that were nice and loaves of bread. And if we begged really hard, she made some cinnamon rolls. And very special times, she would put pecans in the bottom of the pan so they come up on top. And the cinnamon and the sugar and butter
on
the bottom,
good.
And oh, did they make good cinnamon rolls.
And I think you told me that she usually made pies for Sunday. Is that right?
Pies were our Sunday. Yeah, that's when we had pie. We didn't have dessert every day. We just had pies on Sunday, though, because Mom was really into that.
And what about cakes for birthdays? Did she make those?
No cakes except for birthdays. Oh. And that was our treat. Because if we got to choose which kind of cake we wanted for our birthday. And mine was a hickory nut cake.
Hickory nut? I've never had that.
Hickory nuts are very small nuts. And they had to be cracked, and then they had to get the nut meat out of them. And Mother would take the iron and the hammer and pound until you got that little bit of nut out of the hickory nuts until she had half a cup, or maybe not quite a full cup, because she just couldn't do it anymore.
So did you decide that was a little bit too much work for your birthday cake after that?
That was it.
So in addition to all these things, which your mother did, which are just amazing to me, she had to cook every single meal for everybody in the family every day. Is that right?
Yes, the children had to come home from school. There was no school lunchroom. So we had to run home, and Mom had to have meals ready, and often we had soup. Vegetable soup was our favorite, but we had a bologna soup that was out of this world. And on Sundays we'd have either chicken of some kind, that anything that could be left in the oven while we went to church, or pot roast, or a pork rump roast was a good one too. And canned vegetables, and maybe if we didn't have pie, we would have canned fruit, you know, one of those halves of a peach or a half of a pear for dessert.
So not only did your mother cook all this, she made some cough syrup, didn't she?
Oh, we always had cough syrup in the wintertime. And the way it was, you put a pan on the stove, in the back of the stove, where it was warm, and onions and honey, and it would just eventually turn into a syrup, and that was our cough syrup. So we didn't have to worry about that. She did other things for medicines, like cod liver oil was always a winter, always had to take our cod liver oil. And she had warm milk toast if we were sick. We could have that was toast with milk and cinnamon sugar on it.
I also have seen pictures of you when you were young, and you had the haircut that Edith used to give to all the girls. You said it was a Dutch bob. That was shingled up the back, bangs in the front, and sides at the chin, so you looked like Buster Brown. Was that fair?
It looked neat, and we always had to have it cut nice.
And she was the one that did the cutting.
And Mother did it all.
And so with the kids around the house, sounds like you all helped your mother, but did you ever have to go out and get your own jobs too?
Oh, as soon as we were able to, we would get a job. I did babysitting for 10 cents an hour, and I did that in the funeral home that was next door. They had their apartment was upstairs from the funeral home, and it kind of scared me at first to go up and take care of those children, and got my 10 cents an hour if they remembered to pay me.
I remember you telling me that you were babysitting upstairs and there was a corpse downstairs.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But there was a man down there taking care of the people who came to visit.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't just the corpse and you.
I wasn't alone.
Once the kids got grown up and Edith was a little bit relieved from all these millions of tasks, did she get involved in the community?
Well, she had always gone everywhere, to every Sunday at church. So she was involved with the church at all times. And she became an election judge as she got older, and she helped at the church with their rummy sales and anything else that they had to do.
You also told me that with the church they would have bake sales and that her rolls would always go first because they were so good.
Yes. And they had their bake sale in the electric Iowa Electric shop store, that which was right behind our home. So we'd go out the back door. She'd say, "Here, Jean, take these over to the bake sale." Go out the back door and down our steps and over to the Iowa Electric Park, down to the steps and into their shop. And before I could put them down, they were gone.
They saw one of your family bringing in rolls. They knew it was time to bid.
They knew they were mother's rolls.
Well, Edith Bender broke a hip in 1974, and she died at the age of 86. She's buried in Monticello, Iowa, where she raised all of her children. She's an amazing woman, and that's why we talked about her today. She raised 10 children. 3 of her children served in the military. 2, Ralph and Paul, served in World War II. And 1, Charles, was in the military in the defense preparedness time right before Pearl Harbor. He was killed at that time, and Edith became the first Gold Star mother in Monticello, Iowa. Her oldest daughter, Mary, became a quality control inspector for NASA. Her son, Ralph, became a federal probation officer, and her son, Paul, was the postmaster in Monticello. Her oldest son, Jim, was a business owner in Monticello, and he passed his business on to his brother-in-law and then to one of Edith's grandsons who runs it now. In June of 1941, as I told you, her son Charles was killed, and that made Edith a Gold Star mother. Her daughters included Ruth and the identical twins, Fern and Esther, and Kay. They raised families, and several of them moved to California after World War II with their husbands and lived out there. The other daughter is my mother, who's been with us today, Jean. She raised a family, including me, and became a school teacher.
And don't forget, I was also a minister's wife.
That's true. She was a minister's wife, too. Edith now has so many grandchildren that I don't even know how many there are. All of these people were able to live and benefit from the extraordinary life and the incredible millions of jobs that were done so well by Edith Caroline Schneider Bender.
Well done.